Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today was the youngest judge in the state of California ever, man or woman, when she was appointed at age 31 in January 1976. Janet Kintner had never planned to be a judge at such a young age. She didn't want to be the youngest judge in the state, but she felt it essential for women and girls to see themselves represented in the judicial system. She felt there was a lack of understanding of women's issues in the courts. In 1968, she passed the bar exam in Arizona and California, was hired by the Legal Aid Society of San Diego, and in 1972 was ready to start trying consumer fraud cases. Former judge Janet Kintner has now written a memoir, A Judge's Tale, A Trailblazer Fights for Her Place on the Bench. Janet Kintner, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Do you know, I'm a little hesitant to call you by your first name instead of saying Your Honor.
I'm retired. Go right ahead.
Oh, all right. Thank you. Because a friend of mine that had his profession required that he come before judges often, and he saw a college friend of his, and he said, "Hi, Steve." Oh, my goodness. And I knew what he was going to tell me next, that he got in trouble for not saying Your Honor because his friend had become a judge. So just there are a lot of things that people might not realize till they read your book.
Right. But, you know, it's really important, I think, that we take the job seriously, but not ourselves.
Yeah. Well, one retired woman judge said about your memoir that your memoir is personal yet universal. And I thought, oh, my goodness, I certainly found that to be true. And one of the things I noticed early in your story is that your grandmother said, children should be seen and not heard. And oh my goodness, did I hear that when I was growing up. Children should be seen and not heard. So where did you grow up?
I was born in Dayton, Ohio, in the hospital, but I was growing up in Fairborn, Ohio, in a very small town. And then we were there through when I started seventh grade, we moved to Tucson, Arizona for my father's health. So I was in the Midwest and then moved to Tucson.
Well, you bring up something that happened when you were age 10. And it came up a lot of times in your book, and women will understand this. You were only 10 years old. Your dad had this old longtime friend come to visit. And do you mind telling us what happened?
Right. That was when my sister, and I promise I wouldn't say which one, but she went out to the car at night to get something, and he offered to go with her. And he did. And then the next thing I knew, she was crying, and I was trying to find out what happened. And I found out later that he had put his hand down her panties. He had molested her. And you know, it was so hard for anybody to believe that a family member, or even a kind of distant relative or a good friend like that, an almost lifelong friend, would do something like that. But he did.
Well, I think so many women can identify with the group Me Too.
Yes.
And it seems almost to me like there are more cases like this that we're in the majority and not the minority. But so you grow up, did your dad ever compliment you?
He did, but it was so rare. Now, there was that one time after I became a judge is that the one conversation we had that he really seemed to compliment me. Before that, I didn't notice it. But then he said, "You make more money than I ever did." And I said, well, there's inflation, you know. And he said, no, you know what I mean. You did good. And that was, he was really trying to compliment me. And it was so rare. He usually was very critical. So that made me feel fantastic.
Well, I don't ever recall being complimented by, well, actually, even my parents, but I think it's because they expected, yeah, you made grades. Yeah, well, it's like they expected it, so it was no reason to compliment you. But right. Your dad was, he was hard to live with, wasn't he?
He was. And you know, different children may take it differently, but I suffered terribly over it. It really bothered me, his temper, his insults. Yeah. And you know, his father was worse than he was. Oh, and I'm sure he tried to be better than his father, because his father was physically abusive. And that's what the relatives told me. And an alcoholic, but that's what the relatives told me. I don't have personal knowledge. But he was so hard. And my father was the oldest boy, so he got the brunt of it. And he tried very hard to be a better provider. His father had trouble keeping jobs, but my father was a good provider, and he didn't drink alcohol. And, you know, he tried really hard to be a better father, I think. But it still came out, his temper was still there, just like his dad's. And he would rap us on the head with a knuckle, and that terrified me.
My guest is a former judge, California judge, Janet Kintner. Her memoir is A Judge's Tale, A Trailblazer Fights for Her Place on the Bench. And I want to make sure listeners hear the title of your book, Janet, because I carry your book around reading it, and people say, well, what are you reading? And when I would tell them, women would say, oh, I want to read that book. So you already have a lot of eager readers.
Good.
So you grow up in Ohio, but that's not where you went to school.
That was only until seventh grade, and then I went to school in Tucson, Arizona, and that's where I got my law degree, too.
Well, you say that you were just talking to a friend saying, well, because you were on the debate team.
Right.
When you were in high school, wasn't it?
No, college.
In college. You were on your college debate team. And a friend says, you say, oh, I'll miss debating. And what was his reply?
And he said, do you know you can do this for a living? And I said, no, how? And he said, go to law school and become a trial lawyer. So I did.
So off you go to law school. Mm-hmm. And I'm laughing because when you took the... You graduated law school and you want to take the bar exam in Arizona, because that's where you went to law school, but you also want to take the California bar exam. And what happened when you, well, why did you take two typewriters to the bar exam in California?
Right, because the Arizona bar exam turned into a disaster when I was starting out. The first morning, I was typing away. See, my handwriting was so bad, nobody could read it, including me. And at the time, the only other option we had was a manual typewriter. We didn't have computers. I don't think anybody I knew had anything besides a manual typewriter at the time. So I was typing away, and a key flew off. They had little arms on those typewriters with a little type bar at the end. And a letter flew off across the room. And I thought, let's hope it's a Z or an X, right? So I can get through this thing. No, it was an E. And yes. I was just devastated.
Common letter in the English language is the key that flew off your typewriter. Oh,
right.
My gosh. And so we're in suspense. What in the world? How could she solve this problem?
It's really, you're trying to think of what you can do when all you've been thinking about is answering the questions. And so I went out and had to find a payphone. Nobody had cell phones. So I found a payphone and called the people whose phone numbers I had memorized. And I had to use coins, and I only had a few coins. So I knew I had to get it in one of the first couple that I tried. Called a friend and asked her if she could bring me a typewriter. And she'd never been to the law school before, but she said she'd try. And she did. And I just waited out there until she brought it. So I must have missed, I don't know, at least a half an hour to an hour of the exam. But I did go back in and finish it.
Well, you were saying that your handwriting, that even you couldn't read your handwriting. And I didn't know at the time I read that what might have been the reason, I don't know, but you were bucked off a horse when you were young.
Right.
And I was shocked at how much damage was done. You were out riding with a friend. What happened when you were bucked off a horse? You were age 16, weren't you?
Yes. I was a junior in high school, right. And this horse bucked me off. And it was, we were right along the road, so it was hard. It was asphalt and no bushes to land in, which really would have helped. And it just did this terrible damage to my left shoulder and arm. And I had surgery, and they put me in a cast with my arm straight up over my head. So for 6 weeks, I had this cast. So I couldn't go to school because I couldn't even sit up straight. I just kept falling off to the side, and I was in pain. So it was a hard experience. But you know what? It gave me empathy for people who go through hard things, and a lot of people go through hard things.
Yeah, so you have this bad accident with broke your left arm and shoulder bones when you were just a teenager. And you go to law school, and I thought it was amusing. I think people have heard this before. Okay, look to your left and look to your right. And why did they tell you to do that when you went to law school?
Because they said only two of the three of you will be left at the end of the semester. A third will flunk out in the first semester. And that was right.
Actually, from what you said, 3 years later, after that, your graduating class had 117. And you say that was only half the number.
It was.
That started 3 years ago.
Yes, by the end, it was only half.
Yeah. So you made it through law school. And we haven't said anything about, did she get married? What happened there in the love department?
Yeah. I did fall in love my first year of law school. He was getting his master's in business administration. And yes, it was. I'd had boyfriends, but this was different. And we did end up getting married when I graduated from law school.
Well, I imagine there are people out there who say, oh, there's no such thing as love at first sight. Come on, Janet. And you even say, if you had asked me if I believed in love at first sight, I would have said no. But this was darn close.
Right.
So you fall in love, and time goes by, and you're thinking, well, maybe we should get married. And what was his response?
Yeah, he didn't say anything. I kept waiting. And so I just brought it up. I just I wanted to get married, and he didn't say anything. But the next day, it may have been 2 days later, he had a ring and proposed.
Oh no! But he didn't show you that ring right away. I thought this was a lovely scene. What happened? How did he give you that ring?
Right, he made dinner. It was spaghetti, and then afterwards, he said, "Let's sit on the sofa to have our dessert." I said, "Okay," and he went in and got a dish of ice cream, and it was in the ice cream.
So you spoon out some chocolate ice cream, and there's an engagement ring.
Right.
So
that I've been wanting.
Yeah. And then you want to plan a wedding. And did Chuck help plan the wedding?
Not at all. He took off for South America and decided to have a very difficult hitchhiking kind of trip with very little money. And we had no way to reach each other. There was no internet, no cell phones. So he just took off for months. And I said, what about helping me plan the wedding? He said, oh, you don't need me. You can do that. So I did it. Actually, my mother helped. But yes, it was all left to me.
Well, speaking of all left to you, I would not expect you to include in your wedding vows the word obey, because nowadays women, men write their own vows. So did he write his? Did Chuck write his own vows?
Well, I wrote my vows, and then I asked him if he wanted to write his, and he said, no, I'll just say the same thing you do. And he knew I would have obey in it.
Yeah. So he goes off to South America, and we're getting nervous. Is he going to make it back? Why didn't he contact her? Why didn't he let her know where he is? And so we're nervous about what's going on with him.
Right. I was nervous. I kept thinking, how can I invite people to a wedding if I don't know if the groom's going to be there?
Well, there are a lot of things that made me laugh when I was reading your book.
Good.
My guest is former Judge Janet Kintner, and we'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, former Judge Janet Kintner, and she has written a memoir, A Judge's Tale, A Trailblazer Fights for Her Place on the Bench. The difference in men and women lawyers at that time, you mentioned something that were very uncomfortable, and I remember, pantyhose.
Yes.
And you say that when you put on your hoping to be a lawyer outfit, that was a part of your outfit. Would you read what you wrote about that? This is 1968 in San Diego, Janet. And would you read that when you put on your hoping to be a lawyer outfit?
Sure. I put on my hoping to be a lawyer outfit in late 1968. That meant my black suit with a matching jacket and skirt, white silk blouse, and medium height black heels. The worst thing was the tight pantyhose, which all respectable women had to wear. They proved we weren't hookers. A hooker could never get these things off fast enough, and it's not a pretty thing to watch. I despised them and took them off immediately when I got home. I was nervous because working at the San Diego District Attorney's Office was everything I wanted. To be a trial attorney and fight for justice, prosecuting serious crimes and protecting innocent victims. I thought, with my academic history, debate, and moot court, and now two bar exams passed straight out of law school, I would be welcomed. The district attorney was James Keller. I saw many male lawyers in his office, which had a separate area for the female secretaries. I had to see his assistant in charge of hiring, Bob Thomas. The all-business receptionist took me to his private office. Thomas introduced himself. I introduced myself and saw he had my resume lying on his desk. "We will not hire a woman lawyer," he said. That in a tone of voice that said, "I don't care if every man in the world dies. We would rather hire a chimpanzee than a woman." He said it like he was saying, "Don't bother to say anything. This is the rule, and we will never change." I sat there incredulous. That was the stupidest thing I had ever heard. I guess he didn't get past my female name on my resume. Then, as if to explain, he said, "There's too much bad language in the office." I was devastated. I was wiped clean, swept off the surfboard that saved me from the sharks, and left to drown without the tiniest shred of hope for a lifeline. "Wait a minute," I told myself. "This is my dream for the rest of my life. I can't just give up and walk out of here. Give me some oxygen. I need to fight." Regaining consciousness, I said, as if the reason really was the bad language, "That is not a problem for me. I've heard it all before." "No," he insisted, "we aren't going to hire a woman lawyer. It wouldn't work."
This is my guest, former Judge Janet Kintner. She's reading from her memoir, A Judge's Tale, A Trailblazer Fights for Her Place on the Bench. And you use the word incredulous there, and I think a lot of younger women and men would be incredulous to read, is this really how it was back in 1968? And I, because you and I are pretty much the same age. And I, yeah, oh yeah. So the things you talk about, yep, yep, that was the case then. I remember it all too well. So many things that happened to you. And this is why I like that quote, the retired woman judge who said, your memoir is personal yet universal. And I found so much of that that was true. So you have to dress like a woman. You have to wear the proper clothes. You present yourself properly. And then he doesn't want to listen to a word of it. He just is not going to hire a woman lawyer. So another thing that comes up, and I once had my own business, and when they would come in to check the license, they would talk to me like I was waiting on them, an employee, and I would say, no, I'm the owner. And they would insist to see the permit. This wasn't that long ago. So when you would call somebody on the phone, you would get this suspicious look, and and when he sees your name, they don't even want to let you in the office. But anyway, so why don't you, on page 96 in your book, you would have a problem just on the telephone trying to get through to somebody you wanted to talk to. Would you read that section?
Okay, I had the same problem on the phone. I would call another lawyer about a case and say, this is Mrs. Kintner. You know, we didn't use Ms. It was always Miss or Mrs. So that's what I said, Mrs. Kintner. May I please speak with Mr. Wheeler? I'm the lawyer for Mr. Smith on the Smith versus Green case he's handling. The secretary who answered the phone said, put the lawyer on the phone first. I am the lawyer. Let me get this straight. You are the lawyer? Yes, I am the lawyer. You went to law school? Yes, I did. And I passed the bar exam. This was frustrating for me, and it happened many times. I tried to remain polite, remembering to use sugar before vinegar.
That's always good advice right there, use sugar before vinegar. But that must have been so hard when they wouldn't believe that you were. Well, my brother looked so young that he often had to convince people, yes, I'm licensed and so on, because he looked young. Now, you became aware, that it was getting pretty obvious, that when clients were looking for a lawyer, they wanted to know their lawyer would be tough. Now, here you are, woman. Now, are you going to be tough, Janet?
Oh, yes. And, you know, for one thing, any woman who could get through law school and pass the bar exam and become a lawyer back then had to be tough. If they weren't tough, they never got that far.
So, why don't you read that section, too, about what clients were looking for?
Okay. I became aware that when clients were looking for a lawyer, they wanted to know that their lawyer would be tough as nails. Most clients preferred male lawyers, and many assumed that men would be stronger than women lawyers. That had an impact on me. I was determined to prove that I could be as powerful as any man, and I did that. Not in a loud way, but in a calm, rational, determined way. I learned that approach in debate. No matter how many people appeared on the other side, and no matter how much money they had, I just didn't give up. When I tried a case, I argued with sincerity, logic, and conviction. As the years passed, we had more women lawyers, and many proved they could be as strong as any man, sometimes stronger. But in the earlier years, when there were fewer women lawyers, we had to convince people of our toughness all the time. The fortitude that I developed stayed with me, which was helpful as a judge and later as a candidate in my campaign.
This is former Judge Janet Kintner. She is reading from her memoir, A Judge's Tale, A Trailblazer Fights for Her Place on the Bench. So you don't get hired where you maybe deserve to get hired, but you get a job with legal aid. And that, I think people would like to know that about this service. What is legal aid, Janet?
Okay, Legal Aid in San Diego was representing really low-income people. They were really, the guidelines were so very low. So these people were just struggling to make sure they could feed their families and pay their rent. And it was just civil cases. So that's where I started doing consumer fraud. I found all these scams that they were victims of, and I went after them and did great. And they always ended up in the news. So,
in fact, your supervisor with the San Diego Attorney's Office said, "I'm impressed with the press coverage you've been getting for your consumer fraud cases." And I think the situation has only gotten worse now, Janet. Don't you think so? That consumer fraud is worse even than then?
You know, Nancy, I think so. And part of the reason is because of the internet and cell phones. They reach us through our computers, through our phones, through our iPads, every way. And they have gotten so good at it. And, you know, they can do it from Africa or Asia.
Yeah.
And they practice and practice, and they're so good. And I prosecuted these people when I worked for the San Diego City Attorney's Office. But still, I would not want to take a chance on engaging with them. They are so good. Yeah. You don't want to engage. You want to just hang up. You want to just ignore it.
Well, in fact, when you got this compliment, you said, "Could I do exclusively consumer fraud cases?" And maybe not right away, they answered you. But it was surprising that there wasn't this kind of service, I guess I'll call it, consumer fraud, in prosecuting consumer fraud. There are a lot of, you give examples in your book. Does one come to mind in particular?
Oh, one of the cases that I prosecuted was a pyramid scheme case, which is where you pay money to participate with the idea that you're going to make money by getting more people involved. So they're not really selling a product. They always say they're selling a product, but the focus is on getting more people involved. And the person who ran it was really a good con man. He was silver-tongued. You know, he could talk people into all kinds of stuff. And that's how he did it. They made huge investments thinking they were going to make a lot of money, but you don't. Because what happens is it would require endless numbers of people willing to invest, and that doesn't happen. So like this guy, the client that came in to see me in the city attorney's office, he had gotten one other person involved who was a good friend, of course, who was now furious with him because you can't get the money back. It's so difficult to do. But most of the money goes to the guy at the top of the pyramid scheme. So he was making a lot of money.
Well, I remember going to a talk, this was years ago, of course, by Ralph Nader. And for this younger generation, Ralph Nader, who was that? And how does he come up in your book?
Well, they compared me to Ralph Nader when I was starting the Consumer Fraud Unit in the city attorney's office. And Ralph Nader had done great things for consumers, finding defective products. That was part of it, defective products as well as the scams that they have. And like you said, there's so many now. I see them constantly, and I don't know if it takes, I was a lawyer who was prosecuting them, and it's hard for me sometimes to spot them. So I just don't see how people can be expected to be aware of all this.
Well, you said back in that time, there was a writer's daily column in the local evening newspaper, used humor in his column, and you didn't know him, but you gave him a call and told him who I was and what I was doing. And the next day, you're sitting at your kitchen table after work reading the newspaper. And what did you see in this column? Would you read that from your book?
What page is that?
This is page 113.
Okay. Yeah. He said, "Ralph Nader certainly started something. And thanks to him, consumer fraud have become household words. He has competition in San Diego, and it's a woman, no less. San Diego's deputy city attorney, Janet Kintner, the first deputy assigned full-time to the prosecution of consumer fraud." I had to look again. Yes, that was my name and our new unit. It was stunning. I was delighted, hoping this would garner complaints, because I had to get complaints or I wouldn't be able to have a unit, and people didn't know that they could file complaints there. Then more articles started appearing in local papers. Another columnist wrote, Deputy City Attorney Janet Kintner is happy that her new phone number for the Consumer Fraud Unit ends in 007, like James Bond. I was as happy as if Bond had just told the world to send me complaints. It had to help.
This is former Judge Janet Kintner reading from her book, A Judge's Tale, A Trailblazer Fights for Her Place on the Bench. After a break, former Judge Janet Kintner and I will be back to continue our conversation about her memoir, A Judge's Tale. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Janet Kintner, who was the youngest judge in the state of California ever, man or woman, when she was appointed at age 31 in January of 1976. And I think your book is helpful for women and girls to read, but also I think men really had no idea. Maybe even now, it's hard for them to understand a woman's point of view. Do you find that to be the case, Janet?
You know, for some, it really depends. There are some wonderful men who are so understanding and supportive. But I think for a lot of men, and they're so busy doing things, and that they don't all have that.
Well, I mentioned the fact that people just don't understand this generation now that's younger. So you have in your book, you talked to this woman who had been a lawyer, and she was the first lawyer in San Diego. And what was your conversation with her? Her name was Betty. And you said, Betty, what was it like when you were the first lawyer in San Diego? And would you read her reply from your book? This is on page 148.
148, right. Okay, so she was one of the first. She wasn't the first, but one of them certainly. She said...
when she was first a lawyer. Yeah, yeah. She wasn't the first lawyer, but when she was first a lawyer in San Diego.
Right. So she was only a lawyer 3 years. This was like 3 years before I was one, but still, it was hard. She said the Bar Association probate meetings were held at noon at the University Club, where they would not allow women to enter. To attend, I had to climb the outside metal fire escape to the second floor where the meetings were held. Weren't you wearing a dress? Yes, all women wore dresses then, just like we do now. How did you do that? I climbed up the fire escape and climbed through the window. And the men got to enter through the front door? Yes, and they got to walk up the inside staircase. What did you do when the meeting was over? You got to go down the inside staircase then, didn't you? Oh, no, I had to go back out the window and climb down the fire escape. Didn't that make you mad? No, that was just the way it was.
That's just the way it was. And I think that would be so hard for people, men and women, to believe that that's the way it was. She didn't get mad because she had to accept that.
Right. You know, the first Madge Bradley, the first woman judge in San Diego County, said the same thing about so many things, some terrible things that happened to her. And that's what she said, too, just the way it was. She knew she couldn't change it herself. It would take time.
So you were a prosecutor, and then you get appointed judge. How did that happen, Janet?
I wasn't sure, but I did. I submitted my name. Some women lawyers were talking, and one said, did you submit your name? And I said, no. I was only 31, and I was pregnant with my first child. And I was registered a different party than the governor was. And I just
said, Governor Brown, by the way.
Right, right. And
so you weren't even in his party.
Right. So I didn't think there was a chance.
Well, that impressed me that he was willing to do the research.
Yes.
And check you out.
Yes, he really wanted to make the judiciary look more like the state of California. And that meant more women. And there were very few women trial lawyers in San Diego. I was, and I had been elected to the County Bar Association Board of Directors, and I was the only woman on the board. And there'd only been two elected before me since the beginning of time. So that helped. I didn't realize at the time, but later I was told that probably helped.
So you get appointed by Governor Brown, and you expect to continue being a judge, but it wasn't that easy. What happened?
Oh, in 1978, two men decided to challenge me in an election. And 2 years after you're appointed, any lawyer can challenge in an election. So that's what they did.
Do they even have to be a lawyer to challenge you?
They have to be a member of the state bar. Mm-hmm. So they don't have to be practicing law, but they have to be a member of the bar for at least 5 years. So they were.
So they challenge you. And you have to participate in an election just to retain your seat as a municipal court judge.
Yes.
So if you have to run, you need some money to do that.
Yes.
So how are you going to spend the funds? Because one of these guys had all the money he needed. So how did you budget what you had to spend on your campaign?
We hired a consultant just for a consultation, not for the whole campaign. And he told us to use radio ads then. He said that would be the cheapest way to reach the most people. So we did that. We didn't use signs. We didn't use television. My opponent used signs and television and radio, but we just used radio. And I also gave tons of speeches. I spoke to every group that wanted me. It was crazy because I was working full time, but I'd go give a speech in the morning before work. I'd give a speech during the lunch hour. I'd give a speech at night. It was crazy. That's what we did.
So here he is plastered all over billboards and TV, and you just have radio. So if people don't know what you look like, how did you present yourself? You created a brochure.
Yes.
So you had a professional photographer take your picture.
Right.
So how did that go? Janet, would you read that section in your book about, because all these photographs are going to be black and white,
right,
like most brochures were then. And you didn't have time to go door to door to talk to people in person.
And we didn't know, like, which area we should go to if we did go door-to-door. See, now they do. They have so much more information. But, right, and there was no way I had time. I was giving speeches, and I was working full-time. And I had a 2-year-old child at home, and I was pregnant with my second child, who was born in the middle of the campaign.
So would you read that
on page 276.
Yeah.
We had a professional photographer take a face shot to use on the front of the brochure. We talked about what my facial expression should be. I asked, should I smile? Another person said, no, you must look tough. Most people are concerned that because you are a young woman, you aren't tough enough. We know you're tough, but you must show it. Another person said, but you don't want to look angry or too mean. That would be too much. Another said, but have your mouth closed or pretty much closed, no teeth showing and no smiling. You have a great smile, but this is not the time to use it. Got it, I said, and I had my mouth almost totally closed with no hint of a smile. I was consciously channeling, I am strong, I am tough. When I saw the chosen photo days later, after it was developed, I thought I looked like I was having a gastrointestinal attack. But what do I know?
This is memoirist Janet Kintner reading from A Judge's Tale, which is her story of being a judge and how she got there. Now, this photograph is a serious photograph, but you know something that I think would shock people? I mean, I was surprised at it. In the County Bar Magazine, there was a centerfold in the County Bar Magazine dicta. What was that about? And how did you feel about this centerfold, Jenna?
Right. I agreed to write for the County Bar Magazine, which was called Dicta then. It's no longer called Dicta. But I was hoping to, you know, make more of an impact of women and what had seemed so much like a good old boys club. And so I had been writing for a while, and I suggested we get rid of it. What it was pictures of a woman who worked in a law office, usually like a secretary or an assistant or a paralegal or something. And it was, they had their clothes on, but there was lots of legs showing and some, usually some chest, and it was sexy looking poses and the words, they'd put word suggestive words. And it was demeaning, I thought, for me as a female lawyer to have that in our county bar magazine. And all the women lawyers felt that way. We all hated it. But, you know, when I suggested that at the meeting, they all said, oh, no, you're crazy. Everybody loves it. And I was shouted down.
Yeah, and I think people would find, I think maybe men would be more aware now.
Oh, yes.
But speaking on this, kind of on this subject, the sex offenses would be easy to make, but difficult to prove, because the defense lawyer would just try to blame it on the victim. And did you try any of these kind of cases, Janet?
Well, I did, but that law changed. See, that when I was the victim of that crime, that was what the law was. But fortunately, it changed later, and they didn't use that instruction, which looked like it was really telling you to take the victim's testimony with a grain of salt. It was only used in sex offense cases, but it was really a difficult thing, and it made it difficult for women victims of crime, of sex crimes. So that did get changed.
In fact, there were a lot of things that, as readers, we were thinking, what? It was really like that? Because these things, like you say, have changed. And you are often behind these changes. For example, a man and a woman both go to jail. And what did they do for men that they did not do for women in jail? There were a couple of things. And I think people will be surprised. What? They treated women like that?
Two things really bothered me when I was a lawyer and I had clients, female clients in jail. And one was that they had no sunshine. Now, on the men's side of the jail, they had sunshine. They could see the sunlight. But in the women's, it was all artificial light. So you don't know if it's day or night unless you get a watch and figure it out. But that was one thing. And the other was they had no contact visits. The men could have contact visits. Now, I don't know that all of them could. They had to deserve it. They had to probably qualify. But still, men had contact visits, which means their family could come visit them and they could touch them and hold their kids and have a real visit, like sitting at a picnic table. But for the women, they had to do it all over phones with glass in between, even if their kids came to visit. And that didn't seem right to me.
Not only does it not seem right, but I feel sorry for the women. It's probably worse to be able to see, say, their child and
right,
not be able to hold their child and have that glass. So I'm wondering, maybe it was worse to even see them if they couldn't.
Some felt that way. I had a client who felt that way. Right. But I did get that changed. We did get it changed.
Yes, that's what we learned when we're reading your book, that you saw things that needed changes and did something about it. And it is inspiring. Another thing that I enjoyed, too, are at the start of each chapter, you have quotes. And it might not be surprising that you often quote Eleanor Roosevelt.
Yes.
One of her quotes is like, "A woman is like a tea bag." Why did she say that? You remember?
Right. You don't know what she's made of until she gets in hot water. It takes a challenge to really know what we're like.
And then another quote, Eleanor Roosevelt said, "You must do the thing you think you cannot do." And like I say, when I'm reading your book, I think of instances where, yeah, that happened to me.
Yes.
I did something I didn't think I could do. And so that's a quote you include from Eleanor Roosevelt. You include a quote from Gandhi, which I think you would expect. But one from Socrates.
Oh, right.
And I thought, my goodness, how far back did you go? But I really was inspired by so many of the quotes that you opened your chapters with.
Thank you.
Now, something that is kind of an odd question, perhaps, but there was an article in The New Yorker. This woman was consulting IA chatbots. And she says, "I'm writing a magazine piece about chatbots. I can't figure out how to end it. Do you have any suggestions?" And the chatbot replied, "Let there be a purpose. Let there be a lesson." So, Janet, my closing question for you is, what was the lesson? I think more than one, but what would you answer? How would you answer that chatbot suggestion, let there be a lesson?
The lesson, I think, from all of this that I wanted to share with people is that before women were allowed to participate in the law, they weren't police officers when I was a victim of crime. They weren't lawyers. They weren't judges. And it was horrible for women. Believe me, there's a difference. You might think there's a nice man, but there's still a difference between having it be women and having it be men. And we need the presence of women. It makes an enormous difference. And with the presence of women came much better conditions for women. And we felt like we were a part of it, and we could see that we were a part of it. And people who came into the courtroom could see that women had positions of power. For men who committed crimes against women, it was great for them just to walk in a courtroom and see a woman judge and realize that some women had power. They couldn't just trample over all women. And we don't want to give this up. We don't want to go back. And, you know, not everybody favors having women in positions of power. And we really, I think, need to take this really seriously and make sure that we don't go backwards.
Well, it sounds like they should read your book, Janet. I want to thank you for writing this book. And remind listeners that my guest has been Janet Kintner, K-I-N-T-N-E-R, rather unusual last name, Janet
right.
Kintner. And her book is A Judge's Tale, A Trailblazer Fights for Her Place on the Bench. Thank you, Janet.
Nancy, thank you. This was a pleasure.
And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
When she offered to read me her poems, the pages from which she read were ripped sheets of paper bags she'd stored in the woodshed, and I thought then, still do, that voice is a garden where we plant the believable. I'd sit next to her at the oak dining table, a light above us swinging on its umbilical cord, her voice holding Scottish ballads, the rhythm of her words wholly mesmerizing. Head cradled in hand, I'd incline closer to grandmother, who smelled of Sloan's liniment salve for arthritis, her red hair collapsing around her face, hands like weathered, spotted leather. Why didn't I know then she had an expiration date that soon after her last recitation of poems, her heart, too filled with reverence and memory, too filled with words about home in Nova Scotia, she would, days later, collapse to the linoleum floor, hand cupping her heart, mouth askew, unable to scream for help, unable to move, urine soaking her clothes. How long she lay there, unattended in the chill of my grandparents' home. Should I pretend death is the harsh reckoning of time, or a touch from angels, who may or may not have swooned over her poems? An axe stirs in desire's belly. I sharpen on longing. Diana Henning.
When life gives you lemons. The lemons I bought months ago are decaying in a fruit bowl deathbed. This was not their intended destiny, surrendering their bodies to the molting onions, and yet I, the complicit bystander, stood by as their supple innocence withered to that of a golden raisin forgotten in the sun. The plan was always to devour them, to use them up in their entirety, to press their flesh in the palm of my hand and turn their edge into something tolerable. But I've never been one for lemonade. The sweetness makes my feelings ache, and all the best poets stay wary of the overtly saccharine. I've been more inclined to love a sour fruit, slightly bitter even, a good bite to the tongue. In this I should have indulged, down the gullet becoming a sailor, curing scurvy. Better this than plucked from the tree of life only to be tossed and left for dead. Better sharp and living than soft and forgotten. And I had indeed forgotten, ignored their simple raw forms and let the gnats feast, let them devour themselves, offered the garbage disposal a slice or two as the wafts of citrus seemed to absolve months of neglect, tricked me into thinking that small gestures could mollify a life I, in my idleness, had left to rot. Kelly Lieberman.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.